grain of rice. A grain of rice is going to tip the scale. Just remember that, lad.
There's a small bit of a needle there.
Now, come on, Mayo. You've got to get Andy Moran into the game.
Our mission was to show that we're no longer the whipping boys of Munster.
When we started these Examiner Sport podcasts, the experts, people certainly we were listening to and should have listened to, told us don't go longer than 35 or 40 minutes with any of these podcasts because people will switch off. And you know what? They've been proved dead wrong. We've actually, we did a couple of lengthy podcasts. The first one was a sit-down with the former Cork GAA legend Larry Tompkins. It didn't start off as an extended sit-down. It didn't start off as an extended one-hour plus interview. It just turned into a great conversation. And we have continued, and we are going to do a series of those. The second of them was before Christmas with the late, now sadly departed, Garrett Fitzgerald, the chief executive of Munster Rugby. The third in the series is with a man whose name has been in the headlines quite a bit in the last couple of weeks, Declan McBennett, who is the head of sport with RTE and is charged with the responsibility of RTE's entire sports output. He's been in the news, obviously, because Joe Brolly has had his say in terms of the fact that his contract wasn't extended. But we spoke to Declan about a lot more than Joe Brolly. We spoke about everything from television rights to women in sport to female punditry to what makes a good pundit and, in fact, what makes good sports television. Enjoy the listen. Declan McBennett. Sorry, I'm eating a bit of a Jaffa cake in my mouth. You, both of us, actually came into sport from a news background. I was kind of doing politics and health. You were in the north for a long time. Some people might see that as a hindrance. I would see it as a huge advantage in your job in terms of the perspective that you bring to being head of sport. Give me a sense of where you are on that.
It's interesting because I'm 20 years in RTE, heading for 21, and 15 of those were in news, and five, coming up on six now, have been in sport. So again, people who work in RTE will have different perceptions. My perception of RTE, because of my background, has always been that it's about news, sport and national events. It's essentially national moments. Now, the national moment could have been, and I worked on the general election a couple of weeks ago, because it's an all-encompassing project in RTE. So it's about news, sport and national events. So whatever those national events are, be they a general election or be they Stormophilia or be it the All-Ireland final or Dublin five in a row or Ireland playing the All Blacks or the Olympic hockey qualifiers, there's a huge sense there that for RTE, for all its faults, and people will criticise it as they go, there is a sense that when those moments come up, RTE are front and centre of it. What you do have is news tends to be very much wham bam every day. It's a treadmill. Sport is obviously more event driven in television terms, in radio terms to a lesser extent, but it's still driven largely by Saturday sport and Sunday sport, where online in the digital dimension, as you know, well know now, is the one that never sleeps. So it's a constant basis in terms of the turnaround. I suppose what you do bring from news is you bring a very sort of direct black and white decision making scenario around it, where TV people may argue is that because news is wham bam and done on the day, it somehow lacks, sometimes can lack, the production standards that TV like to bring to the table. So news will be whistle to whistle, whereas the television production will be very much everything that goes around that, the prep, the VTs that go beforehand, teeing up, the analysis, etc, etc. So it's blending and mixing those two roles.
It's funny because, and they haven't obviously been all in, you know, sitting down in interview form, but I mean, I go back now and having good chats and conversations and getting an understanding of how you work, like from Glenn, from Ryle, Tim O'Connor before that. Am I forgetting one? No, that's, and then yourself. In terms, no, and I know obviously you don't have a reference point because you're only in the job, as you said, maybe 20 months, but in terms of the job now, in terms of what you have access to now, and in terms of the existing and remaining demands on you now, how challenging is the job and the title head of sport for RTE?
It's extremely challenging. It's extremely rewarding, and at times it can be extremely frustrating. But ultimately, where you've got to start with something like that is that I'm in a very privileged position. I'm the head of the sport of the national broadcaster, which allows us to do the moments that I've outlined: Ireland playing the All Blacks, Dublin's five in a row, the Olympic hockey qualifiers, the November series, the Olympic Games, the Euros, the Women's World Cup last year. Just on the Women's World Cup alone, RTE had never done the Women's World Cup before, and women's sport has now come to a certain level whereby it's what I describe as the crossing of the Rubicon moment in terms of the global impact of women's sport. But RTE had never done it before. We looked at doing it initially, and we were looking at doing four quarterfinals, two semifinals and a final, so seven matches. And then we looked at it and we said, that's not doing that tournament justice. And we had concerns around some of the standard, particularly around the group stages. We had particular concerns, historic, which were allayed over the course of the tournament, around the goalkeeping element within women's soccer. But we looked at it and we said, well, rather than do seven, can we do 15? Can we do 20? And then we looked at it and we got ourselves up into a position whereby we thought we could do 20 to 25. And then we looked at it again and we said, in conjunction with some of my bosses inside, we said, well, what actually if we were to do this tournament real justice and do everything? So we approached TG Cahir and we said, lads, we have some scheduling issues here. There are some games here. We own the rights to this tournament. Rather than let it go, why don't we sit down, see if we can work something out here? So TG Cahir ended up doing 29 games. We ended up doing 23. We did 52 games in a Women's World Cup that built
that
and built
weren't
and built
in.
That we weren't in, that built and built and built, and the group stages got a certain level of audience, and the knockout stages got a certain level, and the semi-finals blew it off the charts because it was England versus the USA, and then the final as well, and people like Sam Kerr and Lucy Bronze and Megan Rapinoe became global superstars, and we were part of that.
But is that how you measure the metric deck of that? How do you measure the how successful that is for you? Is the metric literally the number of eyeballs watching?
No, but it now is a metric, and it has to be a metric. So I've met a number of sporting federations and associations, and I've said to them, because of the world we live in, because of the financial situation, and because of the competitive nature of our industry, you have to look at figures now in a way that you may not have looked at them in the past, because everything would have been, well, it's public service, so we'll do it because it's public service, and the numbers are important but not crucial. So now we look at the numbers in a way whereby, essentially, in very broad terms, if your programme or your sporting event or your occasion is doing 100,000 plus of an audience, it's in a good space. If it's doing in the region of 50 to 100,000, then you have to ask questions as to the merit of doing this, and it needs to be scrutinised. And if you're doing under 50,000, then effectively real serious questions have to be asked as to the long-term viability of doing something like this because of the cost involved, etc., etc. Now, you have to balance that with the public service remit, because we're not just about numbers, and it can't be about the three big sports, GAA, rugby and soccer, that will automatically deliver big numbers. Otherwise, hockey would have never got near television screens, or Reese McClellan in gymnastics would never have got near it. But equally, you have to look at the impact that it is having. And if you look at something, and I think the women in sport thing is something that's particularly prevalent over the last 12 months, but I have issues around that, but if you look at something like that, then you see, well, what's the wider impact here? And the wider impact is, and we're all driven by our own environments. I have a 10-year-old daughter, so I look at the world now in a different way in relation to my 10-year-old
daughter.
Because she plays sport, she plays soccer, she plays GAA, she's mad into it. She's been to Anfield, she's been to the Aviva, she's been to Croke Park, and she's been to a McKenna Cup game in Inneskeen, which is not exactly as glamorous. So, but she's now engaged, she's now involved, she draws daddy in this case, and her opinion is equally as valid as her brother's opinion, and that's the way.
So if you only had boys, Declan, are you saying, you know, this is... I'm in the same boat as you, by the way. I understand exactly where you're coming from. I mean, I want to come back to the women in sport thing, and obviously women in media and all that, because I think it's a very interesting and often divisive debate, even in my own head, by the way, that is. But in terms of... You spoke about all the things you covered there. It, you know, in terms of the perfect cocktail, you know, for... RTE. Yeah. What are the elements of your coverage? I presume it's analysis, commentary. Obviously, you take it as a given that the technical side of thing is going to be perfect, even though I know you did have a glitch at the start of the Rugby World Cup. Do you remember that? I remember that. Yeah. Anyway, we'll come back to it.
Yeah,
what I'm saying is, well. Yeah, like in that situation, what are the elements that you need to get right percentage-wise in the cocktail that you go home at the end of the day and you kind of say to yourself, that was really good TV?
Okay, so you mentioned that I'm 20 months in the job. Like, I'm extremely proud of the output that we have, but we can never, like, RTE has never and RTE should never believe that it is the central component in any of this, because we don't score. We didn't put the ball in the net for Owen Merchant. We didn't save a penalty for Alicia McFerrin in the Hockey World Cup. Our job is to get there, provide an absolutely excellent technical element of in coverage of the game, provide informed analysis, mm-hmm. and I think that's the key thing in terms of informed analysis, and to draw people in. One of the things that I sometimes cite is, if you go back to the All-Ireland final in hurling, it was the fourth camera replay that definitively sort of settled the debate for most people in relation to Richie Hogan and the contact that was made.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know, it's not for me to judge Richie's intent or lack of intent or otherwise, but it was the fourth angle that was difficult. If you go to a rugby match, it's the TMO that says, yes, there was pressure on the ball when it was going down. Yeah. Our job is to make sure that all of that is covered off.
Credit where it's due, the All-Ireland semi-final, wasn't it Limerick and Kilkenny? It was the Cusack stand angle of the sideline cut that did get the deflection and should have been a 65. That was the talking
point.
In fairness, I
think it was Michael Dignan who was immediately on. I don't think he was working that day, but Michael Dignan was the person who immediately spotted that, and then it became a conversation. We became aware of it. The director went and looked for the correct angle, and then it was proven definitively in terms of the nature of what was at play, in the sense of it should have been a 65 and it wasn't. So our job is to turn up, and it could be in all sorts of weather. If you remember back to the Olympic hockey qualifier, not the one that people remember, which was the second one, but the one that was played on the Saturday night,
That's
was
right.
in atrocious conditions.
Weather, yeah.
But our job is to put that on, to provide to reflect the spectacle. I was going to say provide a spectacle, but we don't do that. The players do that. Mm. To reflect the spectacle, to inform people, to entertain people, in some cases to educate people, because again, hockey is like something that an audience comes to every now and again. Most of the nation don't understand it, but it's like the Olympic Games. When you watch the Olympic Games, nobody understands half the events, and then within 10 days everybody's an expert in relation to every event in the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
You know, from Taekwondo to the modern pentathlon, and suddenly everybody knows something about it. That's our job. And in general, with a couple of exceptions, I think we do a very, very good job across all platforms. Like, our radio coverage on Saturday and Sunday, I would argue our radio coverage on a Sunday in terms of the breadth of coverage. And last weekend, we moved all the rugby to 2FM so that the GAA was still covered, whereas on the weekend of the general election, we didn't have a Sunday sport that day because arguably the whole country, and certainly RTE, was consumed by the election. And that's something that we have to do as part of our public service remit.
Yeah.
So something like that is a big decision for us. But our coverage in general, I think, is largely on the mark. Now, there will be people who will be critical. And I've said this before. I think 80% of the criticism is through a lack of knowledge.
Mm.
10% of it is generally off the wall. And 10% of it is largely justified.
Only 10% is off the wall? I'd actually say...
I thought you were going to say only 10% is justified.
No, I would say only 10%. I mean, that is something, Declan, which, I mean, and you, both of us are on social media. Like, at times I find social media an ugly place. I mean, genuinely, some of the lads, I got to be thankful at times to Larry and Cullum sitting around me who say to me, like, you can't respond to that. And it's kind of one of those debates, isn't it? I often think we talk about this sensationalism and people's appetite for it being a new, relatively new phenomenon. But my argument, Eck, is it really? I mean, we've always liked the controversial soundbite. We've always tuned in to, you know, and I'm going to come obviously to the punditry issue as well in this. We always kind of say, I got to hear what he's saying, or I got to hear what she's saying, or they're going to say something. I'm going to watch this because your man is going to go off on one here for certain. Is there still a place for that in sports analysis? That is, I suppose, the kernel of what I'm saying. And I'm asking that, by the way, of myself as much as you.
Yeah, I think there's two questions there in the sense of, one is the social media dimension. And I think social media is brilliant, and I think it's a sewer at times. And I think it's horrendous in terms of the pub conversation now gets magnified into a national or a global conversation. And, you know, I did some work with Joe Kiernan and the Armagh team back in 2005, and I remember one thing that Joe always said. He said the great thing about GAA, because obviously it was Armagh at the time, is that everybody can have an opinion. He said the worst thing about the GAA is that everybody does have an opinion regardless of how informed it is. So now something gets picked up on social media, and people are so personal about elements, be it appearance, dress, the manner in which people do stuff, conduct themselves, and that gets magnified. In relation to the second part of the question as such, is there a place for the controversy? Is there a place for the soundbite? Yeah, absolutely. Part of what we do has to be about entertainment. But I think there's a balance there, and this is part of the balance, in the sense of, I personally, both personally and professionally, do not believe it's about fundamentally the soundbite, the headline the next day, unless that's very informed. So I'll give you an example, and sometimes I've been criticised both internally and externally for using Sky as an example. If you go back a number of probably 6-8 weeks ago, there was a discussion on Monday Night Football involving Gary Neville, and it was about racism and Raheem Sterling, and Gary Neville identified and called out Boris Johnson for racist views within the leaders' debate the time of the British general election, which I think had happened either 24 or 48 hours before that. And one of our Sunday game pundits actually sent me the clip from Twitter in the sense of, have you seen this? And my response to them was, yeah, I've seen it. I'm watching it live. It's excellent. I love us to do that, provided it's informed. And that's the key thing for me. It's not about saying something to grab a headline. It's about saying something that needs to be said, but has some form of basis behind it. Mm. So should Sky and should RTE have a social conscience in relation to the broader society? Yeah, absolutely. If you go back over the years, people would have spoken about Maradona and Pele and people like that sort of coming from the slums or coming from poor backgrounds whereby they didn't have the advantages of that other, but football became their exit route and it became their way out. Mm. And this is something that society has to be conscious of, and et cetera, et cetera. And now you have multimillionaire footballers. So national broadcasters should have a social conscience, and they should allow people to articulate that social conscience, but it has to have some sort of basis. The flip side of that Monday Night Football discussion was that the Sky presenter immediately went, oh, that's your view, Gary, nothing to do with Sky. And of course Sky and Gary Neville rightly came back and went, well, sort of, what are you talking about? This is, you know, you didn't put the words in my mouth, I'm saying it, I'm standing over it, and if Sky have a problem with that. Now, I think Sky got that fundamentally wrong on the night, and they subsequently apologised, and I think they know themselves.
Well, the host got it wrong.
The host got it wrong on the night, but I'm sure there was somebody in the host's ear. So to your point, should it be entertaining? Should it be controversial? Yes, absolutely, provided it's informed. Yeah. Not entertaining and controversial for the sake of being entertaining and controversial and putting one individual at the centre of a debate that should be a much broader debate. That's my view.
Do you feel, and I suppose I'm thinking specifically in relation to Dunphy, in relation to Brawley, who, there's times I've watched both of them and I've actually said to myself, like, that's a great point. You know, that is a great point. You know, these guys have been there. They're both very articulate. And there are other times I looked at them and I thought to myself, you know, what? He's nowhere here. Like, and so I suppose when you're looking at the analysts, and I know you kind of made a few comments when you got the job initially about setting the standard in that regard. But when you're sitting on your sofa watching these folk, Nodek, are you actually looking at them as the person on the sofa, or are you looking on as effectively their boss?
No, the pundits in particular are contractors. I'm not their boss. If Des Cahill or Joanne Cantwell or Jackie Hurley or Darren Frehel, Darren Maloney, Peter Collins, any of our presenters say something, I'm their boss. If the pundits say something, they are contracted to us. Mm. I'm not their boss. I shouldn't be their boss.
But you are, really, though.
Well,
it's like a columnist in The Examiner writes something which is off the wall, ultimately I'll be answering.
Yeah, and ultimately we should be. But but the boss scenario suggests that you have a sense whereby you're either telling them what they can say or what they can't say, or that you're somehow curtailing them. Like this is part of a broader discussion, which I'm sure we'll get to. But essentially, it comes back to the sense of nobody in RTE has ever been told what they can say or what they can't say, and nobody's been ever been told to say something in particular. There are two exceptions to that, and the two exceptions apply to the Examiner and the BBC and Sky and the Independent, the Times, every media outlet. Number one, there's the laws of the land in terms of you can say something about an individual that you can stand over in terms of libel or slander or their reputation. And the second one is in terms of... That's applicable to prime time, to the 6-1 news, to the 9, to anything like that. So you can say it. And the second one is, we have made it clear that we don't want personal attacks. Now, what's the definition of a personal attack?
Exactly.
That can be subjective, etc., etc. But I think we all know that there is a line that you don't cross in terms of personal attacks. And I think we've crossed that in the past. Mm. And I think there was an era in Irish broadcasting driven by RTE, which was very personality driven. You've mentioned two of the individuals. The third one was George Hook, who was very much personality driven and personality centric. And that had an era, and people enjoyed it. And I think people have tired of it somewhat. Mm. Now, the argument of some people is that we're going from that side of the fence to the polar opposite. And the word
stats and...
And the word that is used is banal. And is RTE going banal? And you know, are you trying to clamp down on stuff and make it anodyne? Or vanilla? Or one person has described it as a sort of Rose of Tralee analysis. Mm. And I'll tell you what I told the 30 GAA pundits who were brought into RTE in January every year for the last 2 years, because we have a meeting and we set out the stall for the year. If we go banal, it's not because of any innate conservatism on my part or on the part of RTE. It's because you guys go banal. But I find it hard to believe that Tomás O'Shea or Colm O'Rourke or Donal O'Cusack or Richie Sadler or Liam Brady or Didi Hamann are suddenly going to go banal, because it's not in their nature. We don't want them to do it. But if we go banal, it's not down to any policy or diktat that's handed down from RTE. It's down to the analysts themselves. Mm. And in actual fact, we continue to tread that lane in terms of people don't always like what the pundits have to say.
Okay, so I'm hearing you, like, what you want is a balance. I mean, you're if you were to actually have a prototype pundit, for want of a better word, it would be somebody who's, you know, been there, done that, has great knowledge, but can deliver it in an entertaining way. I mean, if I was to say to you, what are the three criteria for a good pundit on RT Sport? They are?
We've said this to every analyst that we've been involved with. There are three criteria that we set out. Number one is credibility. Number two is an informed opinion. And by informed opinion, I mean something over and above that you're going to hear on the terraces or the pub. And the third is the ability to articulate that opinion. Because remember, in a broadcast environment, you might have 30 seconds to get your point across, or you might have 2.5 minutes to get your point across, or in some cases you might have 15 seconds because you've got three people on a panel and somebody's in the presenter's ear screaming, we need to go to an ad break here. So you have to have the ability to make your point succinctly and distinctly in a very short period of time.
And that, by the way, is frustrating at times. I've heard it from several pundits, and I've even been there once or twice myself, where you actually kind of feel like you're rushing your point, and it's not a discussion like this where you're having a chat.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a weakness probably of multi-match highlight system.
Yeah, and it's also the very nature of television, in the sense that, you know, they're sometimes, if you go back to my old environment, Morning Ireland, you'll hear Morning Ireland after a 2-hour programme say, we apologise to Ryan Tuberty for going over at 9 o'clock because they've gone to 9:01 or 9:02. And people will say, well, how can you go over on a 2-hour programme? But the very nature of things is the discussion panels will overrun. Everybody wants to make their point. Some people have very valid points to make. We live in a world whereby we're dual funded. We have to take ad breaks. This is the nature of things. We run competitions, and that happens. Mm. But a really good pundit pundit, you know, can make their point very quickly, very distinctly, and still still get their point across. Can I go back on one thing? Because again, there is a huge focus now, and you've picked up on it again, in the sense that we are looking for balance, and balance is almost put forward as a negative. I don't think we are looking for balance, because balance is now seen as, well, if you've got X, you must have Y, and if you insult A, you must cover it off with B. I don't think we're looking for balance. Like, for example, if you go back to some of the more controversial incidents, let's take the Richie Hogan sending off. Right, so Henry and Jackie were on that day, and both of the lads said, no, there are extenuating circumstances, the head moved backward, Richie, it's a fraction off on the timing, etc., etc. And Anthony Daly and Don Logue were there, and they're going, sorry, lads, it's a red card, it's a red card. Yeah. That's not balance. We're not looking for somebody to say he was right, he was wrong.
I hear you.
What we're looking for is an informed debate. In the same way that you could argue that a red card is a red card is a red card. And there's no argument around that. But we're not looking for a balance whereby somebody says one referee is great and another referee is terrible. Or, you know, there was a referee who was praised on League Sunday on Sunday night. But equally, there was a degree of controversy around some of the hurling decisions that were made on Sunday night. Again, that's not balance. That's just calling it as it is.
And you had the same issue with the football final, with Johnny Cooper sending off when Kieran Whelan was in the studio that day. And I suppose that leads me to a question which I don't have a right answer to, but because, you know, I'm just wondering what your view on it is. The whole area of having pundits from competing counties.
Yeah, okay. And your colleague John Fogarty phoned me after the All-Ireland final and asked the question, would we continue to have people on from a particular county when that county was playing? And my answer to him then, as is now, is yes, absolutely, fundamentally. The difference is we expect those people to call out their county when there is an incident that needs to be called out. But the idea that we sit back and you have Kilkenny and Tipperary are in an All-Ireland final, and you don't use Henry Shefflin, and you don't use Jackie Tyrrell, and you don't use Brendan Cummins, all of whom are brilliant analysts, and you wouldn't use Liam Sheedy prior to Liam getting the job when Liam was there with Ger Lochnan and Cyril Farrell. To me, that's just a nonsense in the sense of, you know, the guys are there to do a job. They've stepped away from the dressing room. Yes, they obviously have still an affiliation. Sometimes they will wear the jersey, but if a red card is a red card, call it, lads. Yeah. If a yellow card is a yellow card, call it, lads. And if it's borderline, then argue the case.
Yeah.
But the idea that we would somehow, to me, that would be sanitising and balance. That would be the where the balance goes wrong.
I hear you. So everybody's from somewhere.
Yes.
Everybody's from somewhere anyway.
And I think we have a brilliant pool of pundits and analysts now. But their job is to call what they see in front of them. And I don't care what jersey they wore or what jersey is playing in front of them. If they can't call it, then they shouldn't be there. And their job is to call it. So to somehow penalise pundits because their county is playing, to me, is just that's balance gone completely wrong.
I presume you're constantly, Declan, no more than the rest of us, looking for new talent.
Yeah.
And looking for people. Last Monday night week, you probably saw it, Roy Keane and Jamie Carragher had a very interesting conversation on Monday Night Football. Bit of fun about the joint. But I just looked at Keane, and I've seen Keane be personal now. I've seen him call, I think, two Spurs fullbacks dumb and dumber.
Correct.
Which probably crosses the threshold that you're talking about a while ago. But does Roy Keane tick all those boxes that you spoke about as a pundit at the moment? I know he'll argue he wants to get back into management. He's only in it short term. But he's earning his bobs from Sky.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, like, one of the key arguments around something is, if I'm watching this and it gets to halftime, am I going to go and put the kettle on, or am I going to stay because I want to hear the views of A, B and C? And Roy Keane, in large measure, not for everybody now, because Roy has gone on various different tangents at various different times, and Roy is a polemic figure in some senses anyway. But are you likely to watch Roy Keane? Yes, absolutely you are. And that's the nature of the people that we have to look for. But I again come back to it, and Roy has played the game. I mean, the punditry game as much as anybody else. Roy knows that if he puts something controversial in there, it will get picked up. The question is that an informed opinion, or is that Roy playing the game?
Shit-storing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Picking 10 United players and one Liverpool player last Monday night.
And that's the nature of it.
But that's great. But you see, that's the discussion again, Declan, isn't it? That's still great TV.
Yeah, and it's very entertaining TV. Absolutely.
But you have a but there, have
and
you?
And I watch it. No, I don't have a but. Well, I have a but with it in the sense that, you know, I think picking teams for the last 10 years or the last 20 years, or comparing a team, like they did it the other night with the 77 Dalglish team with the 81 Alan Hansen, Ian Rush team, now forward to the Fergie team, now forward to the Mo Salah, Bobby Firmino team. You just kind of go, ah, lads, just enjoy it for what it was. Like, you know, was Mick O'Connell better than Jack O'Shea? I don't know. I didn't see Mick O'Connell. I saw Jack O'Shea. He was a legend. You know, is he better than Brian Fenton? Let's just enjoy Brian Fenton for what Brian Fenton is. Enjoy Jack O'Shea for what Jack O'Shea was, and celebrate the fact that every generation has its heroes, and every generation produces a new set of heroes. And that's David Clifford now. That's Conor McManus now. That's Michael Murphy now.
Sure.
So, you know.
Do you just accept it at this stage? And it was something, actually, one of your, I would say, best pundits said to me recently in a chat, but I won't say who he was. Like, do you just accept it now? When you heard that Joe Brawley rant after leaving, do you just accept it now that nobody's going to walk out the door, Marty, like not having their contract renewed, and actually say, thanks, RTE, it's been wonderful?
No, I don't accept that, because if you look at Robert Hall left us a couple of weeks ago coverage, and Robert was extremely professional, very respectful. By the nature of things, time moves on, and Robert had a lovely tribute going out the door as such, and acknowledged that and came back in email form and text form, and he was, as you would expect from Robert, a perfect gentleman in relation to that. So no, I don't accept, but equally I'm not surprised if somebody doesn't have a contract renewed and decides to have a lash. I think you'd be naive,
because Dunphy did it. I'm not sure George Hook did it or not, but Joe certainly did it. And I saw the Joe one because it was YouTubed by Shane Stapleton on the day, and I watched it afterwards, and look, I'll offer an editorial opinion on this. I thought he over-personalised it. I thought he got too much into Declan McBennett and not enough about RTE. And it seemed that he was laying what he perceived to be the ills of RTE Sport directly at your doorstep. And I am telling you that to your face. If I thought it was bang on, Declan, I'd say it was bang on.
Yeah, I fully accept that. Like, I mean, the best piece of advice I got came from somebody who said, even the winner gets dirty if you allow yourself to get dragged into a mud fight. So there were a number of things that were said by people who have not had their contracts renewed that were very direct, and I've no intention of going there, in the sense that I think the public in general are bored with it, and I don't believe getting into a tit for tat is of any basis. What I will say is this. I outlined earlier on, and when I got the job, that there were three criteria to get a seat on the RTE panel. So you have credibility, informed opinion, and the ability to articulate that opinion. There are two reasons why people leave RTE. Number one is the passage of time means that things roll on. So you had Enda Coller in Once Upon a Time, and nowadays you have Tomás O'Shea, and that's just the passage of time. You had Micheál O'Hare, you had Micheál Amuraheartaigh, and now you've got J.R. Marty and Dara. That's the passage of time. The other is if you're contract gets cancelled. And if your contract is not renewed, then you have to ask, why was it not renewed? And I would say essentially there are four reasons or criteria why somebody's contract would not be renewed. They would basically be that if you are damaging our credibility more than you are enhancing it, if key people on my team come and say, I no longer want to work with A, B or C because it involves too much micromanagement in terms of all the other things that I have to do in order to get a program or a production out, if the manner in which you engage with other people who are engaged by RTE is making them uncomfortable in some manner, shape or form, and critically, if you're not doing the hard yards in terms of
of the professionalism, and you're not doing the hard yards in terms prep. Of the homework and prep that needs to be done. So I think anybody who has a contract cancelled, if they want to understand why they have a contract cancelled, they can probably focus in on those four areas and take it from there.
And just, and I appreciate your, you know, you're not going to get into a tit for tat, and that's but just to clarify two things for me on that that were kind of left, because obviously this is your first time speaking since Joe Brawley left RTE. The decision not to renew his contract, was that based in any way on his performance on All-Ireland Final Sunday on the 1st of September?
Definitively no. The decision with regard to Joe's contract was taken before the first drawn game.
Okay. And he mentioned something that went completely over my head, something about touching Pat Spillane on the arm and that having some role. Can you explain what that was about?
I'll explain it in broad terms, Tony, because I'm not going to get drawn
into
this.
No, I appreciate that.
So I go back to what I said in terms of doing the hard yards in terms of preparation. If key people on my team don't want to come along, or don't want to work with individuals anymore, if you're damaging the credibility more than you're enhancing it, or if your interaction with other people that are engaged by RTE is not at the level that we would want to do. So if I come along to Tony Lean and I say, Tony, your contract's not being renewed, I would expect your first question to be why. And the answer to the why is the four things that I've just outlined. I would expect your second question to be, well, give me examples in relation to what you're talking about. So everything that was put out in the public domain there related back to particular examples, no one thing in isolation, but a combination of examples. But I suppose fundamentally, the key thing that has emerged from a number of those non-contract renewals are along the following lines. Nobody has ever been told what to say on RTE. And we have I'll deal with GAA because that's the area that you've touched on. We had 39 pundits working for us last year. We've 30 working for us this year. Not one of those pundits has come out and said, we've been told what to say, what not to say. We were encouraged to say this or encouraged to say that, or we were told not to say that. So nobody has ever told that. That's not the nature of these things. But I suppose the fundamental issue of this comes back, and you mentioned the Shane Stapleton podcast that was there. Okay, so to be fair to Joe, one of the statements that Joe made in that Shane Stapleton podcast was, the manipulation of public opinion is great fun when you pit X against Y and throw in a few grenades. That's where I have the divergence with regard to pundits. I don't believe in the manipulation of public opinion. Mm. I believe in standards that are informed, that are based up in some sort of fact, not statistical data that has to be churned out, but based in fact. I don't believe in the manipulation of public opinion by pitting X against Y and throwing in a few grenades.
Yeah.
There's the difference.
And interestingly, you've also mentioned there like that you had 39 last year and you have 30 this year, which means there's 8 other pundits, by the way, haven't had their contracts removed or aren't going to be. No, and I'm labouring the point because I haven't heard from any of those.
That's a different. Essentially, what we said, I took over the job on the 1st of June 2018. We met with the pundits in January 2019 in a GAA context. This applies to soccer, it applies to rugby, it applies to every other sport. And we had 39 there. And what we said to them at the time was, guys, we need fewer, better and greater consistency. Because I'll give you an example. Porrick Lodge, one of our commentators obviously, had worked with 16 different co-commentators across football in the year before, in 2018. And if you tune into our rugby coverage, you know you're getting Michael Corcoran and Donal Lenihan, or you're getting Hugh Cahill and Donal Lenihan. And there's a consistency there, and there's a credibility there, etc, etc. And there's a chemistry that allows. So Michael will know how Donal works, and Donal will understand when to come in with Michael
and stuff
like that.
There's a relationship with the listener,
by the way. Relationship, exactly, with the listener. And that's important, and people recognise that, and it's what makes other radio presenters, be it, you know, anybody from Ian Dempsey to Ryan Tuberty, it makes, you know, the audience feel at home with them. You don't get that consistency if you're constantly chopping and changing. It's not that we didn't renew contracts, it's just some of the people that were there previously, we didn't re-engage.
Yeah, sure.
And some of them were on the spot, so they weren't on contracts per se that were there for cancelled. But to your broader point, I'm perfectly happy for anybody to ask any of our pundits, from Didi Hamann to Liam Brady to Eddie O'Sullivan, you know, any of the people who work across our output? Are you told what to say? Are you told what you can't say? Have you ever been instructed to say X, Y, or Z? The answer to all three questions is no.
Maybe one or some should have said that. So after the, well, anyway, that's maybe that's a different discussion. When you're talking, Declan, about the people that you're bringing in for your punditry, and sometimes I actually don't even like the word punditry. I'd rather use the word analysis because punditry, I think, kind of demeans it a small bit. You obviously need now. Sorry, you don't need now. I'd rephrase that, and even the fact that I'm rephrasing it, you know, feels like I'm kind of like dancing through landmines when it comes to.
Yeah, I know where you're going here.
Yeah, female analysis, yeah. Like, and I look certainly. You know, you spoke about the criteria.
Yeah,
and I look at some sports stars, whether they're male or female, and I'd agree with you. Credibility, being there, done that, and the ability to deliver. Is it just a natural thing that you're finding it harder to get quality female pundits on at the moment because obviously just in terms of the numbers game, there's so much more male sports people?
Yeah, and historically it's there because the male pundits have been there anyway, and the pool is much broader and the pool is much deeper. If you take somebody like Ursula Jacob, Breed Stack and Elaine Aylward, three of the female analysts who work with us, all excellent, all have credibility, all have an informed opinion, and all have the ability to articulate that opinion. But the pool is much more shallow on the female pundit analyst side of the house because there simply aren't the level of household names. What broader society now is trying to do, and RTE is part of this, is essentially play catch up. Mm. But there's an expectation that we play catch up in 12 months for something that the male pundits have had 20, 30, 40 years of the Sunday game to do. Now you can go back to Liz Howard and say that there was a tradition there. Exactly. But the pool is still very, very small. Mm. But with greater visibility, and that's one of RTE's responsibilities, particularly around something like camogie or hockey, with greater visibility comes greater name recognition, comes greater facial recognition, comes greater exposure, and therefore people don't tune in and go, who is that individual? They tune in and they go, oh, I automatically know who she is. Mm. Because, you know, I sat at the All-Stars 2 years ago, and this is one of the things, and maybe it's a reflection of my knowledge of hurling, but I sat beside the father of a very well-known Dublin footballer, and the hurling team were paraded on the stage in front of us in the convention centre. And I said, take Joe Canning out of that team, and how many of those would you recognise if you walked down the street?
Without their helmets.
And the reality of it is, because of the nature of helmets, etc., a much smaller number of the hurlers are instantly recognisable than the footballers. Mm. That's similar with regard to female sport because of the lack of visibility of female sport. But the flip side of that is, and I go back to my 10-year-old daughter, is Ursula Jacob's opinion any less credible, any less informed, or has she any less ability to articulate that opinion than Derek McGrath or Anthony Daly or Donal O'Cusick or Donal O'Grady? No, absolutely not. You know, we had the Women's World Cup, so we've Louise Quinn, Megan Campbell, you know, Lisa Fallon. Lisa Fallon, who has worked with men teams.
Over in Chelsea,
Fiona McHale is somebody that we've reached out to before and would like to do more with because she's managed in a you have to have a certain persona, you have to have a certain ability to walk into a men's changing room, command the respect of that team, and they all have that.
Yeah, so you're right, but what you're talking about a meritocracy there.
Yes, absolutely.
You're talking about a merit-based system, which I am 100% behind. Like the Examiner sports team is often described rightly as a very male-centric sports team, and it is, but we have given countless opportunities to female sports writers to want to be journalists, to female sports stars that moved into journalism, and the only one that has stood the test of time, and I hold her up every time I have this discussion, is Therese O'Callaghan. Therese O'Callaghan is absolutely brilliant, and I don't look at Therese O'Callaghan as a female sports writer. I look at her as, I need a really good job done on that, I'm getting Therese.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, Declan, there's a meritocracy. I'm just wondering, where does merit end and tokenism begin at times?
I never advocate tokenism. In fact, I think tokenism is dangerous and damaging to the pundit. So if there's an element whereby we're using somebody in a tokenistic fashion, that actually damages the Ursula, the Elaine Aylward, the Breed Stack.
And by the way, it damages gender equality as well.
Denise Masterson. What I do argue is that until such time as every outlet tries a number of individuals. They don't know how good somebody is going to be.
Yeah.
So somebody, men and women, will be given an opportunity and they will come across as very credible, very informed, but maybe don't have the ability to articulate that nature. And then you'll say, okay, we move on to somebody else.
Mm.
And the pool is smaller on the female side of the house. But
are you going to be as harsh on one of those female tryouts as you would be on a male tryout?
Yeah.
Are you going to be as harsh on a female who might say something controversial as you would be on a Brawley or a Dunphy or whoever else?
If the opinion stacks up, I've no problem with the controversy involved. Will we be as harsh? Yes. Like, we have openly said that we need to try X number of individuals in order to find Y number, because not everybody is going to make it. That's the environment. We've had multiple male panellists over the year that we've used, some of whom are legends in the game, and they didn't stand the test of time. Not because they weren't credible, not because they didn't have an informed opinion, but simply because it didn't work for
delivery
in a broadcast environment.
But
that doesn't take away from their knowledge. And yeah, again, this ties in with the whole social media thing at times. There are female pundits who get criticised and people aren't listening to what they're saying. And
they've made their decision
they've
already.
They've made their decision by the very fact that they're standing there.
I agree.
And why is A, B and C commenting on a men's match? Get out of the cave, lads.
Yeah.
And if A, B and C is not good enough, then argue the point that A, B and C is not good enough on the basis of their performance,
yeah,
not on the basis of the fact that they shouldn't be there in the first place.
Yeah.
That's an archaic argument.
It is. And you, I have to say, are very lucky in that you've inherited a team of actual staff that have some actually excellent sports journalists on them. I think of Joanne, I think of Jackie Hurley,
Claire McNamara, Siobhan Madigan.
Yeah, so you are very well served in that regard. But
yeah,
would you accept that at the moment, it is a hard sell at the moment to actually find the balance there, because you're looking, you know, we're early in the process, I suppose, still.
When it becomes the norm, then we've crossed the Rubicon.
I agree.
But last year, again, go back to the Women's World Cup. We had a panel whereby, I'm open to correction on this, but I think Jackie was presenting, and on the panel was Áine O'Gorman, Irish international, Louise Quinn, Irish international, and possibly Megan Campbell, Irish international.
Mm.
Now, did anybody say that the level of analysis there was not up to scratch? No, because they were commenting on the women's game and they've played the women's game.
Mm.
But
did you have any male analysts on the show?
Yeah, we had Kevin Doyle, we had Richie Sadler,
yeah,
we had a number. So again, you know, nobody said, what are they doing commenting on the females game? You know, so why are we asking the question, why are the female? It's not about whether it's a man or a woman. It's about whether you're good enough and whether the point that you're making is so. You know, go back to some of the controversies or disputed calls that have arisen in relation to the male pundits. So some people can legitimately sit at home and go, is he watching the same game that I'm watching? Because what he has said is factually inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely wrong. But that gets passed off as, oh, they've got a particular bias. Oh, they're wearing a particular county jersey. Actually, maybe the lads just got it wrong on the day.
Yeah. Nobody says they don't know what they're talking about,
exactly,
is what you mean.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, like, I get the sense, Declan, at times, and I know it to a far lesser extent than you do, that I even at the very start of this segment, I talk about us kind of walking through kind of landmines, and it feels like that. I mean, when I saw the Cullum O'Rourke episode recently, and I mean, I must admit, I was home from work on the Sunday night, I was watching the game that night, and like, obviously, given both our jobs, I'd be a little more aware than the normal fella of this kind of stuff. That completely went over my head. I didn't even pick it up. And I saw people, Maura Trasny-Callig being one, you know, making some, in fairness, very good and articulate points that I understood the following day. But I just thought to myself, if anything happens to Cullum O'Rourke over this episode, we're gone mad.
Okay.
We've crossed the
Okay, but you see, again there, Tony, and you're the second journalist to make that leap in relation to something was said, therefore something might happen.
Well.
And another journalist picked up on that. And
that's the world we live in,
and
Dick.
And the word that was used was ousted. Okay?
Yeah.
And I spoke to the journalist in question and I said, okay, everybody needs to take a step back here. So let's go through that because it's in the public domain. Okay. Do I think for 1 second that Colm O'Rourke meant any offence in relation to the language that he used? Absolutely not. Definitively 100%. Colm O'Rourke is a very, very intelligent school principal who deals with young lads who are probably coming out on a regular basis, and I'm sure the standards that apply at St Pat's and Navan are second to none. Yeah. So do I think Colm meant any offence? Absolutely not. None whatsoever. In fact, I think his track record would suggest exactly the opposite. What happened that night? What happened that night is, in as far as I'm aware, Conor Cusack picked up on the comments in Cork. David Goff picked up on Conor Cusack's comments. And then because David Goff has a number of followers on Twitter.
And has a profile.
And because of the nature of what he does and because of the great work that he has done in relation to expressing concerns around mental health and sexuality, etc., that was picked up on. What happened in the subsequent 24 hours was... I was tagged on the David Goff tweet. So what happened in the following 24 hours were there were 2,000 reactions to that tweet and a second tweet. Okay, so David Goff said what he said on social media, and one individual whose name escapes me replied back saying basically that was not the intention of Colm O'Rourke. Don't be precious about this. And then people like Maura Trasa came in and said, it's not for others to interpret how one person interprets what was said. It's for them to learn from it. There were 2,000 interactions. About 1,300 were agreed with what David Goff had said, which was that the language could be interpreted in an offensive manner and perhaps there is a need to move on from that language. And there were about 650 to 700 who said,
get over it.
Colm O'Rourke had absolutely not a single, not an iota of intention to insult or even offend anybody. So there you had a 2-to-1 split in relation to a comment that was made. The difference is, in the world that we live in, that played itself out in social media. Whereas a while ago, going back a number of years, that would have played itself out between the two individuals concerned. Somebody would have lifted the phone and said, you know, maybe you need to be more conscious about your language. Maybe that shouldn't happen. And we now live in an age of instant information. So Colm says something, Conor Cusack reacts, David Goff reacts. I fully take on board what David Goff had to say. Yeah. And I think the point that everybody learns from this is that the language that we use is an evolving language, and language that was used 10, 15, 20 years ago now has an entirely different meaning and people have an entirely different interpretation of it.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, do I believe that Colm O'Rourke meant any offence? Absolutely not.
So rather, it wasn't a Monday morning landmine for you. You just basically said, I'm not getting involved in this. I'm having no conversation with Colm O'Rourke.
No, actually on the Sunday night, because I was tagged in on the David Goff tweet, I alerted Colm to the fact that David had an issue with the language that Colm had used.
All right.
And Colm responded and said that himself and David had already been in contact. Now, to my mind, two mature individuals at the centre of the language that would be used were now having a conversation. If RTE want to row in on the back of that, then we fuel the controversy, fuel the debate, fuel the discussion, and suddenly we're taking one side. You know, is Colm O'Rourke going to be ousted? Are we going to throw Colm under the bus for something like that?
Mm.
Absolutely not. That would be insane. It would be balance gone mad. It would be PC gone mad.
Mm.
Do we as an organisation and all our pundits across every code need to be acutely conscious of the language that they use? Maybe that's the lesson from we learned.
Yeah.
But no fault attributed to Colm, and certainly no fault attributed to David or to Conor Cusack in the manner in which they interpreted.
I think, by the way, PC has gone mad. That's the first thing I'll say, Declan. PC has gone mad. It doesn't seem okay anymore in society, as much as like television or television, if you drill it right down to television analysis, to actually get something wrong. You know, like we always will get something wrong. I'll get stuff wrong today and I'll get more stuff wrong tomorrow. And I'm sure on Friday I'll get more stuff wrong again. It just seems that people now seem to be wheeled out, hung, drawn and quartered for every slip of the tongue. My point in saying this to you is I would hate to think, and going back to our early comment about analysis and punditry, that you get to a point where people are now going to be like so careful about what they say that you're just going to have anodyne analysis completely. Yeah. I mean, I go back to the Sky thing. You might tell me there's a reason for doing it. every time that there's a fuck or something from someone in a crowd of 60,000, Sky feel obliged to apologise for something that you might have heard there. Like, yeah. What is that about?
I think we all take responsibility for our individual actions.
But exactly,
yeah. But the need to apologise on a collective basis, I think, has probably gone beyond the beyonds. It still comes back to the same thing. The world is evolving. We are now acutely more conscious. Let's stay with Sky for a second. Graham Souness spoke on Sky about the homophobic culture that existed in Premier League soccer when he was playing. He then went to the Pride Parade in Brighton and he said he got his eyes opened and his generation sort of need to understand that the world has changed. Does that make Graham Souness a bad person? No. Does it suddenly mean that Graham Souness had a road to Damascus conversion? No, absolutely not. To your point, are we going to be banal? Or is it going to be vanilla? Is it going to be,
because of
Rosa Tralee? I don't think so. I don't think the Tomás O'Shea's, the Donald Cusack's, the Didi Hamann's, the Eddie O'Sullivan's, you know, like Eddie and Jamie during the course of the World Cup, Didi and Liam during Champions League or Ireland qualifiers, Donal Logue, Brendan Cummins. These lads are all more than capable of articulating what they need to say, and none of them put a tooth in it. And I think everybody has to be grown up about it.
Yeah. Let's move on. I wanted to chat to you about the whole area of rights. Again, in previous cups of coffee and what chats or whatever I used to have with Glenn or Ryle Nugent, I remember one of them, and obviously I'm paraphrasing because I don't want to misquote them, I remember them saying to me, Tony, you need to realise and we need to realise that the day of RTE owning everything and having the rights to everything is long gone.
Yep.
And I get that. And that isn't just a market phenomenon. That isn't the fact that you've Virgin Media. That's the fact that your own pockets are a lot shallower than they have been. And Dee Forbes has articulated that. In terms of you used the word earlier, I don't know, was it in context to this, or frustrating? Like, is that probably the most frustrating, Declan, part of your job, that you're watching Rog and these guys on Virgin Media last weekend and you're kind of thinking, like, you know what, like, we really should have the Six Nations. That should be our... That must be a frustration.
There's an element of frustration at that. But, like, you can't have everything in the sweetie shop, and the world has changed as well. And as you say, our Director General, Dee Forbes, has articulated that RTE, and it's in the public domain, need to save 58 million over the course of the next 3 years. We live in a new reality. So, you know, are there... It's changed over time, because if you go back to when I was growing up, you had the Bill McLaren and the Jim Sherwins and the Six Nations, or the Five Nations as it was then, was automatically on free-to-air television.
Yeah.
And then the Skies of the world came along and they blew everybody out of the water. And then BT came along a couple of years ago and blew Sky out of the water, and Sky didn't have a kick of European football in any competition for a number of years. And now what you're seeing is, if you take the German example for this year, what happened was Amazon came along, bought Tuesday night by putting tens of millions of money over and above the existing bid on the table for Tuesday nights. And DAZN as a streaming company came along and bought Wednesday night by blowing Sky out of the water. And you see what's happening with Amazon Prime, who dipped their toe in the water with the fixtures
League.
In December and then came back on. So the world has changed. We're now no longer getting outbid by pay-per-view, we're getting outbid by streaming channels, and that's the nature of this, and this argument won't go away, which is what I've said before. Every association, every federation has their absolute right, be it the GAA or the Champions League, worth millions or billions, depending on the market, has the right to extract from their broadcast partners every last penny that they can, and then what they do with it is up to themselves. The flip side of that is that every association and every federation has an onus and a responsibility to remember that there is a difference between revenue and exposure. Because you can have all the revenue you want and your game will die. And there are specific examples around this, particularly in terms of cricket, to a lesser extent in terms of Formula One. And what you saw with the World Cup in cricket last year was that the World Cup actually, the final involving England actually
went free to air.
on Channel 4.
Channel 4, yeah.
So there's we're back to that word balance again. You know, it's almost become obsessive in the modern day language. But I think in this case, there is a balance to be struck between free-to-air and revenue. And you see it playing out now in every single sport. And it's happening across Champions League in soccer. It's happening across Six Nations. It's happening across the GAA, whereby there are multiple platforms there. But for me, not as a fan as much as a professional involved in the sports industry, where does revenue stop and exposure start? Mm. And I think, again, the best example, and people will say, well, you're quoting scripture to suit yourself here, but the best example is the Irish women's hockey team. Because they were essentially playing the World Cup and it was being broadcast on BT. And they were doing really well. And then we sub-licensed them when they got to a knockout stage. Now, let me be absolutely clear about this. RTE didn't put the ball in the net. RTE didn't lift a hockey stick. RTE didn't save a penalty. But RTE took that, and through the exposure that the hockey team got, they became national heroes. Mm. Not because of what RTE did, but because RTE exposed what they were doing. So it became it became a sensation. Then you come on to the Olympic hockey qualifiers. And on a Sunday night between 6:30 and 9:00, in a very, very family-friendly environment, they go to a penalty shootout to qualify for the Olympics. Mm. And the girls or ladies or women or whatever we want to call them became national heroes again. Mm. Take the Women's World Cup. And again, it's female sport. But because it's female sport, it's probably not quite as contaminated or as reliant on the commercial element that's there at present. In the participating countries, you mentioned earlier on that RTE covered, together with TG Cahir in partnership, covered the Women's World Cup. In France, those games were getting 11 million. In the UK, they were getting 11 and 12 million because they were on free-to-air television. So Lucy Bronze and Jill Scott and all these players, Bette Mead, all became national sensations because of that.
Yeah, I get all that. Is that your pitch going forward? Like, that's your pitch going forward when you're competing with money.
Yeah.
But when you're competing with Virgin, which is also free-to-air, like, what's your pitch then? Like, you're obviously not going to sit idly by with your hands in your pockets and accept the fact that going forward the Six Nations is going to be on Virgin.
No, RTE will go into every rights negotiation on the basis of trying to acquire rights. And obviously there is a sort of a hierarchy, for want, in terms of national moments, national events, etc., etc. And then you come further down the line in terms of you kind of Champions League, a global event, but with actually very little direct Irish input in terms of players. We're not in the days of the Dennis Irwins and the Roy Keanes and but it's a global tournament and everybody wants to see Messi and Ronaldo and Salah and Van Dijk. So RTE naturally will be in that space and we will bid for everything. But RTE has to be realistic in terms of what it can retain. And again, we're concentrating largely there in this discussion around the three main sports. Mm. Horse racing, hockey, gymnastics, the things that I've said before. I've made the point repeatedly that RTE used to have, in relative terms, £100 to spend on three sports. Now it is €80 to spend on five sports.
Right. That's a good point.
And that's the nature of the industry. And sports will come and go. Hockey wasn't on the horizon a number of years ago. Gymnastics certainly wasn't on the horizon a number of years ago. But boxing was front and centre. Mm. Now boxing has gone off to another. I've spoken at a number of engagements. And one of the things I say in relation to the RTE argument, and again, people can say, oh, you're quoting scripture to suit yourself, or of course you're pursuing your own agenda. But I ask the question, where were you when Houghton put the ball in the England net? Mm. Where were you when O'Gara dropped the goal? Where were you when Katie fell to her knees? Where were you when Ruby came round the elbow? Or when Sonia crossed the line? These are the moments that people remember. I remember where I was.
But are they? You are citing scripture, yeah, there, Dick. I mean, where were we when Johnny Sexton kicked the goal? And Virgin have that, you know. So,
but it was still free to air. It was a national moment because it was free to air. You know.
So you're saying they're not as much of a of a thorn in your shoe as the ones with the deep pockets?
No, but essentially, Tony, it's not really about being a thorn in anybody's shoe. Of course, there is a competitive nature there. But the argument goes beyond that in terms of what does it impact on a nation? Let me give you an example. Shane Lowry. Mm. Okay, RTÉ Sports Personality of the Year last year. Phenomenal success. You know, what that did for Clara, what Tiger Roll does for Summerhill, what Ciara McGeehan does for Portaferry, you can't bottle that. You can't measure that. Mm. Okay, and I said, you know, we live in the technologically most advanced world that there's ever been. There's not a single device on this earth can measure what Cian Lynch and Declan Hannan and the boys in Limerick did for children in Limerick by winning the All-Ireland, because that's the exposure you get. So everybody runs out into the back garden, and I guarantee you there were lads practicing this week trying to puck a ball between their legs and catch it the way Cian Lynch did last weekend. And that's the difference, where you could create national heroes. National heroes get created largely because of national moments that are enjoyed by a national audience. Shane Lowry is a national hero. He wasn't free to air on Sky Sports. Can have national heroes. But Clara was on the 6-1 News. Shane Lowry's granny was on RTÉ, in the Examiner, in the Irish Times, in the Irish Independent. Yeah. It's about creating the experience around that means that we can have national moments, we can have national heroes. And the more associations drift in the revenue direction towards streaming services and all that. Now, in 10 years' time, I could sound like a complete dinosaur, because we'll have 5G in Ireland and there'll be broadband and there'll be streaming services and everywhere, and you can pay your subscription and you can take what you want. And maybe 500,000 people will watch Dublin Kerry on a streaming service rather than 500,000 people watched Dublin Kerry 3 weeks ago on RTÉ.
Dick, I say you can guarantee that's what you'll be looking at.
And so that's the evolution of the argument. And RTÉ has no divine right to acquire things simply because they have always had them. The world has changed, and that's the market that we have to involve with. But I wouldn't be doing my job, and RTÉ wouldn't be doing its job, if it didn't go in and ruthlessly fight for every key sporting right that was there. Mm. But can we do them all? Absolutely not.
I mean, look, we're of a similar vintage. I'd say I've probably got a few years on you still, like, at this stage, but like, the fundamentals don't change.
Nope.
You know, the fundamentals should always be the same. But realistically, and I use this metaphorically, we're playing a different ball game now in terms of how we consume sport.
Yes.
You know, live streaming of matches, we're involved in it ourselves.
Yeah.
I can see a situation where Croke Park will start subletting rights out to individual counties. Like, is it going to just become more and more of a dogfight percentage of the market going to become more and more fractured naturally by these type of things? Is that something that you're going to have to accept? Are we going to pine for the good old days of 2020 when you had these rights in 5 years' time and you're not?
I'd be lying to you if I said I knew the answer to that question. Yeah. But I'll give you two different scenarios at different ends of the scale. If you put Barcelona versus Liverpool in the Olympic Stadio in Rome, or put it in Wembley, and there's 90,000 there, you can't put 190,000 into the stadium, so it's going to be broadcast somewhere. So the key is that the mass global audience get to see something like that.
Mm.
The flip side of it is, and I have said this again, I think there comes a saturation point with regard to coverage. And I'd argue...
I'd agree with you, by the way.
People will almost say that I'm arguing against stuff here. But I saw Jarlett Burns in an interview yesterday. He's going for the presidency, obviously, this weekend. And he was saying, we have to be conscious of the saturation nature of our games. Because if I'm going to a match... if I'm Joe Smith and I'm going to a match in Parky Kiev next Sunday, and I'm going to take my 10-year-old son and I'm going to bring my 76-year-old father, okay? But that match is on TV, and I decide, actually, it's a terrible wet day in February or January or whatever, I'm going to stay at home. I don't go, my 10-year-old son doesn't go, my 76-year-old father doesn't go. The audience is now down 3. We've seen this, Jarlett was citing Armagh TV, whereby the attendances at the athletic grounds have dropped in some cases because Armagh TV are streaming.
So
games.
He's advocating what? Removing the rights?
Well, I think he's arguing, far be it from me to articulate what Jarlett is advocating, but I think he's arguing that there has to be a wider view as to how we look at broadcasting in general here.
I agree.
You absolutely saw it in relation to RTÉ's club coverage. One of the things that I am most proud of since I came into the job is that RTE as the national broadcaster has extended its GAA footprint from 4 months to 9 months.
I agree.
We've the National League, which is doing very well for us, and you see those moments being created again.
You've the Championship, and then you've the club.
And then we've the club. Mm. But we saw, and you were impacted on this as well, and so were TG Cahir, whereby RTE or TG Cahir go to a game, stream or broadcast a club game, the attendance drops, and in Kerry, Kerry then make a decision to say, actually, no, we don't want live broadcast coverage of this because it's affecting our gate receipts. Now, if you drill into that, as I understand it, and you've covered this in the Examiner, but the rationale behind Kerry was, we built a centre of excellence. We promised the clubs that they would not be levied in order to pay for the centre of excellence. If our gate drops by 4,000 people at a 10 euro go, that's 40,000 euro. We still have to find that 40,000 euro in a different forum. RTE and TG Cahir are not going to pay 40,000 for one game in relation to that rights fee, so we now have to go back and possibly levy the clubs. So why would we let broadcast coverage in? The flip side of that argument, go back to what I said earlier on, is should one county see David Clifford play in that county final, or should 32 counties and a global audience
through
GAA go?
Or should 10,000 see him play, or should a million or 900,000 or whatever?
And if you want to go back to our club coverage this year, the highest audience that we got was for the Kerry doubleheader featuring David Clifford, because David Clifford is the modern day...
Puts bums on seats.
He's the modern day Mikey Sheehy, who was Stevie McDonald, who was Stephen O'Neill, who was Gooch Cooper, who is Conor McManus, who is now, and arguably he's such a wonderful talent that everybody wants to see him. I understand the Kerry argument. I understand the broader argument, and then you take it through to a rights argument, and somebody goes, "Well, what are we doing here, lads? Are we streaming it? Are we deferring the coverage? Yeah. Are we looking?" There's an issue at play for all the broadcasters at the moment, whereby live sport is where it's at. Deferred highlights is not where it's at. Deferred games as a whole is not where it's at, because people now know, by the nature of phones and radios and everything else, they know the result. It's not the same experience if you're sitting down to watch a match already knowing the result.
There is the issue as well, of course, Declan, in terms of talking about bums on seats, where if an association or a national organisation gets too greedy, we could be looking at a scenario down the track where everybody actually has it at home in the comfort of their own thing, and there's hundreds in the ground instead of thousands. If you were to take that to its nth degree, and especially in a country like ours where inclement weather is such a factor, like, let's face it, we don't live in Los Angeles or Miami here, you are in a situation where people are actually going to say, you know what, I'll just watch this on the laptop.
And that goes back to the point that I made earlier on. I don't think we're a million miles away from that sort of scenario whereby, it's strange for somebody who is involved in TV rights and radio rights and to say that we have to be wary of the saturation factor. I think we do have to be wary of the saturation factor. And I think there's probably a balance to be struck. And I think you see it. I think a good example of it is the championship in England in soccer, whereby there are games on Sky that are simply wallpaper in the background, and then when you get to playoffs at the end of the year where you've Leeds or Aston Villa or whoever, then they get a massive audience because the Premier League has actually finished and you're now into the scenario of Wembley and stuff like that. But these are grounds that still field 20, 30, 40,000. But then you look at them some Monday nights or Tuesday nights or Carabao Cup matches and stuff like that, and the grounds are empty. I looked at the Etihad the other night. Man City were playing West Ham last week. There was nobody at the... Well, when I say there was nobody at the game...
Yeah, there was a lot of empty
seats. There was thousands at the game as opposed to tens of thousands at the game. Yeah. This is Man City. Like, this is a global entity. And they can't fill their stadium because the game against West Ham is on the TV.
Just finally on the rights question. I mean, obviously, everybody knows out there, because you've said it yourself, that RT is cash-strapped, it's under financial pressure. Does that leave you with one hand tied behind your back in terms of bidding for stuff because people know you have a weak hand, perhaps financially, or certainly a weaker hand than you would have had?
But I also think there's a realisation among the federations. Like, the federations watch this kind of stuff very, very closely, and they know whether they're working in a buoyant market or a depressed market.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look at the coronavirus this week and Wall Street's going to take billions of a hit and all that kind of stuff. So there are factors completely outside of our control. It goes back To me, when you boil it all down, it comes back to the same argument. The federations and the associations extract the maximum that you can get, provided you're not sacrificing the global exposure or the national exposure of your game in favour of revenue, because there are now concrete examples whereby that has not worked. And arguably, they need to be aware of that. The RTE financial situation is well known. We can't hide away from that. Does it mean that we're going in with one hand strapped behind our back? No, it means that we're going in with not the financial clout that we once had. But we would argue that in terms of television, radio, online, social media, there is so much that we can bring to the table. And part of our job in terms of the visibility, whether it's Irish hockey or David Clifford, is to help create the heroes of tomorrow. For my father, it was Pele. For me, it was Maradona. For my children, it's Messi and Ronaldo. And again, for I've told the story before about coming out of the Kerry Monaghan Super 8 game in Clonus, whereby Monaghan were leading by 3 in injury time, and I made that schoolboy error of tapping my two boys on the shoulder and say, have a look at that scoreboard, this doesn't happen too often, I'm old enough to remember 79, etc, and big ball goes in, star knocks it down, David Clifford, there's 7 men. If you look at the photo, in the brilliant photo that was taken in the Irish Times, there was 7 men between David Clifford and the corner of the net. And such was his genius that he managed to get the ball in the back of the net and we draw. And Monaghan came out that day and they were utterly deflated. And I was standing, Marty Morrissey was doing the Marty squad, and Jack O'Shea and Nudie Hughes were standing there. Absolute icons in my era. And I said to James, see that man over there? That's Jack O'Shea. That's one of the greatest legends of the game. He scored a goal in 1981. I'll show you on YouTube tonight. And he's amazing. And he was one of the greatest players of all time. And he's from Kerry. And without missing a beat, my then 10-year-old, now 12-year-old, said to me, but what about the Gooch? And I said, yeah, the Gooch is a brilliant player, but he's a different type of player. And the realisation for me there was, Jack O'Shea was my hero. But Jack O'Shea meant nothing to my 10-year-old. But Gooch meant something to my 10-year-old. And there's 10-year-olds out there today who want to be Cian Lynch, or they want to be Messi, or they want to be Ronaldo, or they want to be David Clifford. Part of our role as a national broadcaster is to create heroes for the next generation. And that comes through visibility. And that can be Chloe Watkins, or it can be Kelly Harrington, or it can be Katie Smith, or it can be Ellen Keane. It can be every much a female sporting hero as it can be a male sporting hero. Katie Taylor. Go back to the boxing scenario, and again, it's rights. Katie Taylor's, I would argue, but again, you know, with bias, Katie Taylor's defining moment is when she drops to her knees in London and Jimmy's on commentary, and it's there and it's amazing. Katie Taylor has gone on to do amazing, stunning things in the world of boxing in America, behind pay-per-view, behind pay-per-fight. You know, you look at Tyson Fury and Wilder the other night. Again, it's all... Does that have the national moment? To my mind, maybe not as much. Does it make millions for the individuals? Yes, good luck to them. Does it make millions for the guys around them? Yeah, good luck to them. Where's the balance?
Last question. You're not necessarily your in tray, but your to-do list for 2020. Well, I know, like, you're not going to obviously give away. You're not going to give away your negotiating positions. But in terms of, okay, what do we need? Do we need better commentators? How are we on analysts? And where are we on rights? We don't have the Six Nations, but we have the soccer. We have the GA pretty much locked away. Where else do we want to go? You're nodding your head and saying maybe not, but I would perceive that you have the GA pretty much locked away at the minute.
I'm not sure Croke Park would say, I take your point.
I'm saying this as a joke. Like, what is your to-do list, Declan, for 2020 and 2021? What are you looking at?
Okay, so in terms of the output, we have, subject to the coronavirus, please God, we have the Euros, we have the Olympics, we have the GAA Championship, we have the European Cross Country. And again, that's another example of a whole new generation and a generation of new Irish who are going to win medals, won them at the European Cross Country before Christmas or just after Christmas. Will win, hopefully, please God, coming. Reese in Kelly Harrington at the Olympics, all these. So our job in 2020, collectively as RTE, is the best output through the Euros, through the Olympics, through the Championship, through every other sport. Reese, Kelly, all the Olympic sports that are there that don't get the same level of prominence. The O'Donovan brothers, you know, who became global superstars and certainly national heroes as a result of that. In the broader context, I've said before, I'll say again, RTE is in a very good place for the next 2 years in terms of rights, because we have the key summer tournaments up to and including the World Cup for 2022. and we learned valuable lessons and positive lessons with regard to the Women's World Cup last year. So in terms of rights for the next 2 years, we're in a very good place. A lot of the rights are due to come to the market over the course of the next 12 to 18 months. Okay. At a time when RTE, as we have acknowledged publicly and during the course of this discussion, are in a vulnerable place in terms of financially. My job is to box clever, to fight hard, to try and get what we can get, and to keep reminding people and federations that what RTE brings to the table is still, thankfully, for all its faults, for all its critics and for all its mistakes, we bring a national audience, and we do that, and we'll continue to do that across news, television, radio, online, social media, whatever it is, that dimension that creates the next David Clifford from Jack O'Shea, that creates the next Katie Taylor or Kelly Harrington or Chloe Watkins or whoever it happens to be. That's my job, that's my role. And I go back to the very first answer that I gave you. Yeah, I sense it'll be frustrating, but I sense it will be rewarding. I sense it'll be extremely challenging, but I sit in a privileged position as the head of sport for the national broadcaster to be even involved in those negotiations. And all the rights holders will push extremely hard, and they will say there are no guarantees and the world's changing. And I think the German example with regard to the Champions League is the classic example of that, whereby the pay-per-view, who had tens of millions to spend, got blown out of the water by the Amazons and the DAZNs. So if you get remotely complacent, you're in serious, serious trouble.
Declan McBennett, thanks a million.
Thanks, Tony.